Welcome to In Production, conversations on the research and development of time-based artworks. Hosted by MPAC's engineering and curatorial staff, we talk to artists, technicians, curators, scholars, and makers associated with the production of new work here at the Curtis R. Priam Experimental Media and Performing Arts Center on the campus of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. Through interdisciplinary exchange, this podcast series contributes insight into the creative and technical act of producing artistic works by those who work backstage and behind the camera. Hello, everyone. My name is Ryan Jenkins. I'm a video engineer here at MPAC, and I'm going to be your host on today's episode where we talk to Bailey Sheska as well as the group of curators from the Bard Center for Curatorial Studies that put on this production, including Eduardo Alfonso, Guy Welchek, Min Sun Jun, Angie El Balares, and Isabel Achenbach. I was really excited to talk to Bailey. I had talked with them early on in the process as we were discussing what MPAC could bring to the project that would be different and that maybe they hadn't had access to before, what kind of things our technicians could bring to the project to alleviate any certain stresses about putting together a larger scale theatrical multimedia show. And I really was interested in their kind of DIY aesthetic and approach to making work, how Bailey is really involved in all aspects of the production of the work and the depth of research that Bailey had put into the material. There was a lot of other stuff going on in the building, so it's also kind of an interesting opportunity for me because normally I am part of these larger scale productions, but because of all the other stuff that was going on, I was kind of tied up with a bunch of other projects during this time as well, and I kind of had to take a back seat on this. So I kind of looked at it from the periphery, and I saw a lot of cool stuff going on, a lot of people seeming to have a whole lot of fun. And I was really excited to kind of see the show, get into the show, and talk with them about how it was all going. And it was kind of my way of kind of the FOMO setting in of what looked like a really fun and hilarious production. And I'm glad I got to sit down and get to know everyone a little bit more prior to the premiere of the show. So let's get into it. Here we go. Yeah, so why don't we start? I have all of your names, and I know your names, but if anybody is listening, obviously, they won't. So it's good to just associate the names with the voices.
So I'm Eduardo Alfonso, one of the five CCS Bard curators.
I'm Guy Welchek, another CCS Bard curator.
Hi, I'm Min Sun, another CCS Bard curator, and I'm Korean.
I'm Bailey Sheska. I am the talent.
Visiting artist.
I'm Angie Arbelaez, and I'm also one of the curators.
My name is Isabella Achenbach, also a CCS Bard curator.
Right, and so even to like start off, this, you know, you guys are from the CCS Center for Curatorial Studies, right, at Bard program, second year students. And so this is, I believe, the fourth year that MPAC has been doing a cooperative sort of production with the CCS program, right? So this, can any of you just give like a brief synopsis of like what your role in the whole project has been, right? So you've been working with Vic Brooks, one of our curator of time-based media, but you've been kind of spearheading this thing from the beginning, right? From selection of the artist, all the fun of organizing everything, the meetings, all of that has been you. So just kind of like fill us in on what your role has been through all of this, maybe? Anybody?
Who wants to take that one?
Oh, I can take it. Okay. Yeah, so we all got together as part of the CCS program, as you said, 4 months ago at this point,
four?
At the beginning.
More. Well, more. I mean, we.
Sorry.
Time is a blur in COVID.
Yes. September.
You wanted to take the question, but right. Immediately.
I mean, we met almost two years ago when we started the program, but we started conceiving of this project.
October?
At the beginning of our second year in September 2021.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
However much that is. Now minus that is how long ago. I don't know how to do that in my head very well. Not good with numbers.
Yeah, and we all sat down and worked out a selection of visiting artists to invite. And we all, you know, sort of brought different ideas to the table and came to the conclusion that we should invite Bailey, who we all really agreed that your work was very compelling. And we're very interested to have you work in residence at MPAC because of the sort of multimedia and theatrical aspects of your work. We all were very interested in seeing how that would play out in the space of MPAC, which obviously has, you know, all kinds of amazing facilities and technicians and, you know, the ability to really expand on Bailey's practice. Yeah, so that's kind of the germ of the idea. And as you said, we then started many, many meetings and emails and group chats. And
yeah. And so did any of you know, did you know anyone before this? Like, did you know Bailey, one of you know Bailey, and that kind of is what opened it up? Or had you seen the work somewhere? Or?
It's like such a small world because I went to Cooper Union for college undergrad with Eduardo. And then Isabella and I worked at MOCAD. We worked at the same time. Yeah, so in Detroit. So I knew two of the five curators before.
And curatorially, like, I mean, this is something I don't know a lot about at all, but like, it's not incredibly common to work with five curators at once on something, right? Like, usually I've always envisioned it as this like solitary thing that then you bring other people into, but and you know, might have groups of curators that you might work with or share stuff with. But like, I think how has that been, like working with five curators at once on something? And do you still think of it as like this was a curator project? Because like, I also think of it as like production, like you're producing something. It's like very, very involved in the production process, more so than I immediately think of as what curating normally is. And that's kind of something that MPAC does, is that like almost everything we do is new work and everything is produced. So like there's constantly this blurring of like curating versus producing, basically, because all these works are like being manifested during this process.
I would say that most curatorial projects are a group effort. Mm-hmm. This one is maybe unique in the sense that our structure has been like completely lateral. Like there's no chief curator delegating roles. We've all worked pretty laterally. So, I mean, that's one, I think that if you ever hear of someone saying that they were the only curator on something, they're probably lying.
A little suspect. Yeah. A little suspect situation.
But, and then what was the other part of your question was?
I think you nailed it.
Production, yeah.
Yeah, like like producing, because in a way it feels like a lot of this is producing. And is this the first time any of you have been that involved in that producing of work? Or has it been fun or interesting or anything like that? Horrible?
I mean, I would say that, yeah, I guess in terms of production, this is like a very new mode of like creating producing something, because but it's still, like Edgy was saying, it's still a very collaborative process. Like, it's not unlike producing an exhibition, because you're working with a lot of you know, it's not just you and the artists, it's, you know, art handlers, you're working with the communications team, with administration, like so many stakeholders are involved. So I would say that it's pretty similar to what like at least my experience has been here.
And you kind of jumped right into it with theater.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not like it's pretty deep of a practice to like jump
crafty,
into.
Though. Yeah. There was a lot of crafting.
I've seen a lot of paint on hands that I didn't always think.
I think that was probably really unique.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cardboard and paint.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, but during the process, I learned so much, because like I worked on the performance project before, but it was my first time to work with so many different people in a very different section, like audio, video editing and everything. So I guess all of us, like was maybe most of us, it was very first time working with very different like fields or mode of working. So thanks Bailey for giving us this opportunity.
And me too though, because I usually do these puppet shows like in my parents' living room or in like a theater I built for Zoom, or I've done like in dive bars, or the worst, in the middle of a gallery, in the round of a gallery. Makes no sense.
Yeah. And I mean, so as we get into that, let's just like recap the, let's try to encapsulate in four, five sentences, if someone were to be coming to the show tonight, like, how do you describe that? I know we have on the website, and I know what I just experienced, but I don't think me describing it at this point does it justice, really. So, like, what is your elevator pitch description of, like, what the show is right now?
Well, I've been doing this persona. This is, like, alter ego performance persona named Old Put, who is a shape-shifting alien clown. I've been doing them for about, like, 11 years. And I write these kind of saga-like plays for them. And the puppets kind of came about because, you know, there's characters that are like human chairs. So how do you do a human chair in a play? A puppet, you know? It's like talking objects and things like that. Checker's ghost, President Nixon's dead dog is a character. There's a life-size beanie baby of Princess Diana, or the one that commemorates her.
Played by Sarah.
Who has been amazing.
Our stage. Oh my gosh. One of our production
technicians. So good. What a dream come true.
So many surprises.
So
we always joke here that we have in most of our job descriptions something called other duties as assigned. So there's like every time you find yourself in one of those situations of like, suddenly I'm playing a giant purple beanie baby. Yeah. It's like totally within my job description to be doing this.
So. And she's been so good at it.
She's natural.
She really has been great. Yeah,
she's been embodying that character. But so for this show, I was looking at like Tammy Faye Baker and all these different aspects of like religious cult culture in America right now, and I wanted Old Put to become famous for being an influencer. Mm-hmm. And so like, what does that mean? So as a conspiracy influencer, and those actually exist.
Right,
which
right.
is wild. There's like QAnon influencers.
Like there's an Instagram persona person that like, you know, they try to.
They'll be like, Trump's wearing a red tie, so that means it's actually JFK wearing a Trump mask.
Right. Yeah. And they kind of plant the seeds that then disseminate yeah. through like all of the networks of different people.
Yeah.
You should interview them next.
Yeah, that's who, I mean, that's who's the next residency is,
it will
you know,
be a QAnon
people,
influencer.
Yeah, it's a QAnon residency of,
I could say a few, I just don't want to shout them out.
Yeah, exactly. After we'll make some arrangements. Cool. Yeah, you know, I was thinking about it a lot, even from, and watching it, and you used the word saga to kind of describe the things you've written, but going into it, thinking of it as a puppet theater play, and then watching it, one of the things that really stood out to me was the dialogue. Like that, it feels like a saga or like a theater piece in that way. You know what I mean? Like there's a ton of dialogue that's constantly going in and on and through it. And so, you know, when I was originally thinking of what I thought it would end up looking like or describing to people that it was puppet theater or things like that, you know, I kind of had this very different immediate response of what I thought that would look like. And then in actuality, like watching it, it's like very a script of like really crafted language and written sort of like poetically going through all of it, which I thought was like a really interesting surprise, you know, that it feels like a written book that then is being like shown, but it's being shown in this like typically not topical
childish,
but typically
or,
childish
yeah.
and like, you know, very flashy and a lot of you know exaggeration and it's kind of like a lot of movement and everything, but then watching it felt almost like a Shakespearean, you know, recital of like this long beautiful script.
The scripts are amazing, and Bailey writes all of her own scripts. It's important to say.
I usually can't sleep at night, so I just will write them on my phone, like until like 3 a.m.
Do you swipe type or do you tap type?
I tap type.
Oh wow, that's good.
So just in the dark. Yeah. So, and when I had a job, I won't say where, but I was at a front desk.
Being a very good employee.
And I would just, instead of doing work, just type the scripts.
Type. Yeah.
But I think like one of the things that attracted us so much to inviting Bailey to MPAC was the way in which like these scripts have so many different allusions and references. And when we were trying to understand like the kind of expertise of the team and the different things that people here focus on, like the fact that Bailey's script on the one hand references like Wagner and this like the saga operatic tradition, but also references like TikTok and very Real Housewives and very like topical lowbrow contemporary culture. We were like, this has something that will hit with every single person from the kind of expert on classical music to
right.
just someone binge watching Netflix.
Well, I think it's nowadays more than ever, like that's the same person. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like the person who is like really deep in the knowledge of something also like sits in the bathroom on TikTok for like 35 minutes, like then forgetting how much time has gone by. And they're like, oh, I just swiped through 406 second snippets of video. So it's like, you know, kind of all in the same world, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, as far as that process goes, you kind of discussed your writing process. Like, is there a lot of heavy editing like through all of that? Is it kind of like the stream of consciousness kind of thing? And it just is like, this is it. And it feels like it's done. And then you move on to just making more.
I wish I had more patience to edit. But
it's not fun. No. It's not very fun.
So I kind of go with like the patchwork melange that everything kind of ends up becoming. There's parts in the play where I'm like, do people understand my internal logic of why this is happening? Like Old Put does a Tammy Faye number where she's singing to the, or they're singing to the corn baby.
I had that same thing with my wife. She was like, what are you doing today? And I was like, how do I describe what is happening right now? So I just sent her some pictures. I figured that's the best way, honestly, to try to get it across.
But I was like, let's leave it in. I love it.
Do you feel like that reflects your mood? Like, do you feel like your writing is it's reflecting your moods and the kind of like genre-defying aspect of the plays being like romance and tragedy and drama and comedy?
I think it's reflecting like my fears. Every show is like kind of like based in this like fear or anxiety about what's happening in the world, and then I kind of just try to like riff on that, play with that. So
And I mean, do you find that as like inspiration to make work, or do you feel it is like therapeutic, that like the process of writing about it or wanting to act it out or to like, you know, embody it in some way is like in a way kind of therapeutic? Or is it more like you know, I just wonder what this feels like, let's pretend to do this for a bit and see where it goes, and you know what I mean?
Well, one of my friends asked like, okay, so this show has like over 40 handmade Beanie Babies in it that I had to make. And he was like, was that a lot of work? And it was like, no, that was like the therapy, the like crafting, the creating. I really enjoy that. And then doing these shows is almost like I want to explore these ideas that scare me or frighten me. And I wouldn't say it's therapeutic, but I don't know, it's something.
Yeah, it's happening in a couple hours. So it's got to be something. And I thought about it too, like the counterweight, like there was in the description, this idea of like, which I think is very obvious and you've alluded to, of this, the variables in play there of like these really dark ideas and dark topics then combined with this like childlike and, you know, joyful, colorful, playful experience, you know, and sort of like the balance between those two things to like, in a way, make it like safe. That's how I feel about it. It's like when, you know, like Blue's Clues or something, like broaches a very deep subject to you and you're like, I don't want to address this, but like, it's blue. And so like, it's okay. You know, like, or it's like, I'm comfortable in this because there's this playfulness to it. And it kind of like forces you to simmer in something uncomfortable for maybe like a longer period of time. And I think that's, you know, I thought that was really interesting. And then the various ways that we all you know, kind of do it, or other mm-hmm. mediums that feel that same way. Like I really like small things, yeah. like dioramas and like yeah, miniatures same. And oh, things same. Like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it's like, but
you
so
the
like
tiny crafts that you make with your tiny puppet.
Yeah. And you know, so part of that to me is like, oh, like it's in, I can control it and it's small mm-hmm. and it's like a microcosm of a thing. And then I can kind of build in that and play with it as a small thing. And I like, you know, if the theater experience obviously has these, the theater filmmaking, right? All have these similar parallels yeah. of these like mm-hmm. microcosm building that you then can be in and explore in and like find things about, you know? And so have you felt extrapolating these characters and spaces like into a theater stage, like that same kind of feeling of like, or the creative process in these mediums as this kind of like microcosm that you can control and like play with?
Oh my God, it's a dream come true.
Yeah.
I told Edgy I'm gonna be so sad when this is over because I like love living as old put. But then it's like, oh wait, I just do this on my own all the time. Like, what am I talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Like I'm constantly like painting my face alone.
Yeah.
Making
yeah.
my videos.
So. Follow her at By Leonie.
yeah, follow my
oh,
my socials, yeah. But and even going back to when you were saying like the that there are these childish things, but there's very dark ideas. I was thinking a lot about Matt Stone and Trey Parker in South mm-hmm. Park. They have this great quote that's like, "You should say the darkest things in the brightest colors." Mm-hmm. And that's kind of always been my ethos.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I thought taking some of these like dark. Political ideas and just showing how childish they are, like literally with toys and things.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting play dichotomy.
Yeah, totally. And definitely like the absurdity of it.
Yeah.
Kind of come across through these like absurd characters visually, you know what I mean? It kind of reinforces some of that.
I hope it's not nihilistic. Because there's like a lot of things that I like are like obsessed with and love.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
joy.
But I think we were also all looking for like a kind of like as curators looking for like a form of humor to like unpack a lot of experiences that we had in grad school, which was during the whole pandemic, election saga,
yeah,
insurrection.
It's all in there. Yeah.
It's been heavy.
Yeah, and contemporary art right now is like overwhelmingly dealing with all of these questions and group exhibitions. If you go to the city right now, every show is about unpacking post-COVID, post-insurrection trauma.
Uh-huh.
And I think we were really eager to bring like satire into that conversation
yeah.
and humor
mm-hmm.
Because it seems like the weight of these things
now's
is like really
time.
Overwhelming
yeah.
and humor has kind of fallen out of the contemporary art vocabulary in many ways, and I thought it was important
yeah.
to bring it
yeah.
back in.
Yeah, totally.
I think there's one other angle too to the playfulness aspect of the plays, which is that I see it, it's kind of like a gloss. It's like it's like a gloss the way that we'd experience entertainment culture, reality TV, or social media or whatever, and how that kind of glosses over our fears or glosses over the things that we just don't want to acknowledge. And the polka dots and the colors and the makeup and the like sort of artificial qualities that come into the plays are reflective of that.
Yeah.
Totally. You know, I think with our original phone calls, when we were kind of like discussing where you kind of would describe to us your current process from like a materials perspective and the places you were performing and everything, you know, it seems like you've been kind of the performer, the planner, the builder, like everything has kind of been this solo experience and like byproduct of you, like all of the things kind of come out through you because your hand is in everything that happens. So as far as like the residency goes and like the production of the work in this new environment of like the process of what it's like to take it from that position into this position. How has that been? Like, do you feel like you've had to like give up some types of control at certain times? And has that been difficult, or has it just been like overwhelmingly like, thank God somebody else is putting that video on that thing right now, because I don't want to deal with it.
It's been a learning experience for me for sure, because I'm so used to being like, no, let me do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Get away.
Yeah.
I mean, just even having this many curators, which will probably never happen in my life again. I don't
know. You never know.
I've really enjoyed it, and we all really get along. So, like, I don't know. And everybody at MPAC is, like, on top of their game. It's like, I can really trust everybody. And being able to collaborate has been so awesome, because I don't really ever get to do that.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, like, as far as in your other work, like, is collaboration, and a lot of people, like, they describe it as, like, collaboration is a really important part of that artistic process, and self-curating of, like, figuring out what they like and don't, but it seems like a lot of your work is, you know, painting specifically as a medium, mm-hmm. and other things is, like, very you alone doing it.
Yeah, it is, and yeah. I like that, like, weird, like, lonely obsession.
Totally.
Like, always working.
Yeah,
always, yeah.
Yeah.
What am I doing today? Sewing a costume.
Yeah.
Just being able to, like, explore all these different parts of art and culture is just really fun for me. But being here, it's like Mike will have an idea about something in the staging of the play, and it's, like, amazing, and it really adds to it. And so, I don't know, I've really been enjoying that aspect of theater, or even working with the curators, too. Like, you guys have had, like, really great ideas about, you know, things to do with the puppets, or even the playbill. I never would have thought of something like that. I don't know if anybody wants to talk about. Putting that together has been amazing.
Does anyone want to talk about that?
The playbill mimics a Broadway musical, Hello Dolly specifically, which Eduardo saw live
with Bette Midler. Queen.
Presciently
she's coming.
Saved. Oh yeah, yeah, and saved, archived, and so we sort of built upon that model and created a who's who in the cast, a starring roles feature. We had headshots of all the puppets. There's
which Michael
10,
here did. And
10 characters total. Those are all, they're all handmade except for Old Put, which is Bailey's character.
Hand-painted.
Well, I think it's also like, the curator is all of us, and Bailey are all within the same 5-year age range.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a big part of this.
Yeah,
too.
So
yeah,
there's like
sure.
a lot of references are definitely like very specific to when we were growing up.
Childhood.
Like, yeah. And the playbill was also a way to give some insight into these different references that, like, Princess Diana Beanie Baby, like, for those of us that
there's an age range that you don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
I was totally. Working at another college, the younger students didn't know what was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or didn't believe me that it was a real object.
Yeah. I mean, Beanie Babies themselves, some kids don't know, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of things in the play that are shockingly real.
Yes. Yeah. That's
like
the other thing.
The gray pride Skittles.
Was a real product.
Yeah.
A gay pride's gray Skittle.
Yeah,
was somebody real?
Yeah, somebody at Skittles headquarters was like, what are we gonna do this pride? Let's take the rainbow away. So they made gray Skittles.
Oh my God.
Which is like so psychotic.
Right. Well, that's kind of plays into the whole thing too, right? Of like, it's amazing how real the psychotic insane ideas that you bring up, and you're like, people really think that can't be true, like people believe that, and then you find out like they actually took away the rainbow for the pride Skittles. It's kind of insane, you know what I mean? And then you're like, so which parts
are real.
Which is real, which is not, like,
the
I don't know
the wackiest stuff is real.
Yeah.
And I kind of went into, like, when I started writing them, I was thinking about all these movies that were like having a comeback, like The Matrix, and that's huge in QAnon culture too, Red Pill, Blue Pill,
right.
So yeah, I was thinking like Doors of Perception.
And
the Skittle thing too, just before we move on from that, I always really appreciate it because it was such a perfect encapsulation of the like shrewd and cynical media manipulation. Yeah. Like, I, you know, it's like, yeah, that idea is completely psycho and borderline offensive, but we're still talking about it. You know what I mean? It absolutely is a super effective way to manipulate.
It's
you
like,
know.
Yeah, part of my personality now.
But the genius of it is that then also the Grace gay pride skittle, the super topical contemporary thing, ends up unfolding into like a very precise retelling of Plato's cave metaphor from the Republic.
Goes back to the Matrix, yeah.
The whole thing, like the ideas get wound up in this way where...
I hope Plato doesn't sue us.
I think those are all...
he's pissed. Somewhere really mad.
He's up in the world of the forms, shaking his fist
but
at
also,
us.
But also, like, in the play, the skittle is, like, mimicking the Ms. Green... Mm-hmm. too, which like I always grew up like that's like who I had a crush on.
Yeah.
So I was like, I also like explore all these things.
Those lips.
Yo, like... I could not get over those boots. And they changed them.
Bring back the boots.
The white strongly worded. She had white go-go boots, right?
Yeah. Now she has like Stan Smith Adidas.
Ew.
M&M's, if you're listening.
Yeah. Stop playing games, M&M's.
Yeah, bring my go-go boots back.
Bring back the cha-cha heels.
I need those cha-cha heels.
Billy, I don't think I told you about this. Of course, I didn't grow up in the States, so I learned so much about the culture from your writing. Of course, I know Princess Diana, like Beanie Baby and Barbie doll, but like... Tammy Faye, all this other stuff that I learned so much from you. And I had a hard time, first time, like, to understand, oh, what's this? And I had to go back, I had to Google that, but yeah, I learned so much.
I'm here to teach everybody about American culture.
So that was, most interesting thing for me.
Yeah, and so, like, in actual puppet building, mm-hmm. that whole process, I know I read somewhere that you went to... had a like a understudy or trained in the art of puppet building?
I applied to for a grant program that this puppet art theater in Detroit was doing.
Uh-huh.
And oh my God, luckily I got one.
Yeah.
And they're not even there anymore. But yeah, so like I had like real puppet taskmasters that taught me everything. Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's like a, would you consider that like an art form that is going away a little bit, or is there like going to be a resurgence of puppet?
Just like, even in Detroit, there's a resurgence.
Yeah,
there's like all these other puppet theaters popping up.
Yeah, I was going to ask. You know, like in that culture, there, like, is there like a network of puppet folk that, like, you know, you can make these things and like on a instead of going to play at your like punk club Friday night every Friday, there's something there's like just puppet people that are like doing puppet shows all the time, because it seems like there, when I was looking at it, like there was a lot of puppet related
events. Is a odd puppet town.
Yeah,
they were the first in the 30s to have a union, the puppet workers. So it kind of goes far back. And then the Detroit Institute of Arts is the only museum in the U.S. to believe that puppets are art objects.
Right.
Like display them as art objects.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. So it's kind of cool that you can go see like Monet and Howdy Doody.
Yes.
In the same hallway.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe Checker's Ghost.
So. Yeah, well, we should.
I did think too, like, it's probably a bad analogy, but at times it was like I almost felt like I needed to pretend that I was listening to like rap lyrics or something. Like, it was going so fast.
Yeah,
and there was so many references and so many things that were tying to one another that I was like visually being bombarded with like visual stuff, and I like wanted to pay attention to it necessarily, you know, and I was, but then I had to constantly be like checking my brain to be like, what was that reference, like, what was this, what was this, and like trying to draw the lines through like everything that it was. It was like very engaging, like puzzle work to try to like, before you moved on to the next thing, to have connected all of the pieces. And it was like, I really like doing like chess puzzles. And I like constantly felt like, like I was like, oh, I got the, I got to pay attention. We're going to the next, we're on the next thing now. And I need to like figure out this thing. And you know, I like was just wondering if part of that
writing process? Like, is it an intentional sort of like, how much can I cram in to like one thing at one time? You know, like it just feels like it's moving really quickly. You know what I mean? And like it's not even like the stage is changing really rapidly or things are coming on and out and it's just you out there. So it's not like there's eight different people.
Yeah, I know, it's but just it me. Still it's so is crazy.
Like, it's like a train that's just like rolling down the tracks and like you kind of have to try to keep up. Because if you don't, you know, 30 seconds go by and you're like totally lost because you didn't get those references at those times, you know. Is that kind of like part of the experience that you want people to have?
For sure. I learned how to write when I was a kid watching wrestling promo videos, which I believe is an American art form. And so I would try to write my own. So those are really fast, really crazy. We'll reference all these crazy things. And so about 7 years ago, I started writing thinking back to my childhood, being like, I was so sick on the playground. Like, I would go home and write, like, my promos and wrestling.
Yeah.
We yell at each other. and it's almost like slam poetry.
Exactly. Like, that's what I was kind of thinking of. It was like, you know, just people who rap really fast. And I was like, I'm picking up words and then it's gone and it's on to the next thing. And I'm like, how is this going to rhyme with that? Oh, she's making this reference that, you know, ties in with this or whatever. And so it was just like a very deep, attentive listening that needed to happen to kind of catch all of the different things that were going on.
It's also why I published some of my plays a while ago, because people were like, it's just so, I just can't keep, just a cacophony.
Totally.
And I think to your point, like, that's what's so nice about creating the playbill. Like, it was a format where we could kind of extend the universe of Conspiracy Influencer, but in a way that was straightforward and digestible for people that have that experience. Because it is a lot to kind of take in all at once. And there's a lot of, as Minson was mentioning, like, references that maybe might not be super legible for folks that either didn't grow up here or within like our generation.
And our 5 years. It's like very tight.
How old are you guys, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 21. Going on 22.
Okay, I guess I should.
Oh no, we're all not right.
I'm 36.
Yeah, no, yeah. We're right there. With you.
Did you get the references?
I got all okay. Totally.
Yeah.
But I almost had 30s. A thing. I had a thing of like, I got the references so much that like I would just get sucked in to like one, because there's like this nostalgia factor that happens too, you know? So like you kind of get your way of entering in to the piece a little bit because, you know, it triggers some nostalgic moment or thing that you can relate to. And then I would like have to stop my brain from like reliving my own like nostalgic
trauma?
Moment about like my own like,
childhood trauma.
In my case, yes. My Beanie Baby trauma is true. And, you know, and then I'd have to do that same thing of like, oh yeah, there's a show going on. Like my brain is like all the references my brain was going through and I needed to like focus on what was happening. So, you know, I think, that, you know, that element of opening up that like nostalgia portal for so many people, it's really interesting. And also from like a timely perspective of like, you know, in your other interview, I heard you talking about like it's a time capsule in like a sort of weird way.
They all
of
are.
Like,
yeah.
You know,
all my
capturing
plays are.
A thing.
It's the weirdest. Yeah. Or like even references in these, I wrote these last summer. I'm like, this is already like not within the zeitgeist. It's only been a year. Yeah. Things in politics, things in culture. Yeah. It's weird how fast things move now.
Yeah. And just like disappear. It's
and
like
disappear.
They move,
yeah.
But they just like go away. And you're like, wait, did that happen?
Well,
yeah,
guess,
that did happen. Like there were people.
I guess the gray Skittles weren't rocking everybody's world or anything.
Yeah,
last Pride, what they did for me. But even that's like a year old reference now.
Yeah, it's also interesting the way that these things are nested within each other. Like there's like Tammy Faye, for example. Like
Queen,
yes. Queen, but none of us were born at the watching Tammy Faye live, but Tammy Faye was really propped up through RuPaul's Drag Race.
And his producer made a documentary about her that I've probably watched like a jillion times.
The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Very good.
And there's also an ideological through line from somebody like Tammy Faye to like QAnon.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
I mean, that might be a stretch, but I personally don't think so.
I don't think so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So those kind of references when that really goes all the way back, you know, that goes back far in the history of the U.S. particularly and just whatever. So yeah, these kind of like you're really tapping into sort of like this real bedrock of, you know, wacky dark shit that this country is founded on.
Yeah. I was one of the other. Yeah, always. We can't talk about like the 18th or 19th century and 18th century versions of those because then we'd be offending some religions. the last Bard CCS project we did, one of the students, Paulina, had this great quote where she posted or shared something about it. It was like, if you think the news is fake, like wait till we tell you about history. And it was like, you know, all this stuff of like, you know, I mean, all of the, it's very interesting that the people that participate in these conspiracy theories of, you know, it's always these interesting hypocrisies of like, this isn't true. Nobody that tells you any of this would be true, you know, but this is true, that this is this other thing that,
because
like...
Because I've been blue-pilled.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, and then it even becomes, yeah, you know, it's like, what am I blue... Like, I probably have swallowed some blue pills at some point on something that I don't even know that is, like, super messed up that I'm, like, participating in or thinking about or I think is a reality that's, like, clearly not. And to me, like these last couple of years, since Trump really has been this experience of like, you know, trying to look at things that I think people are blue pilling on, but also realizing that like I kind of have my own, like you know, everyone has these own like pockets of. Echo chambers of things that they're participating in thinking in, and you're in it enough that you think like, well, this is the right way and everyone else must be like stupid or something. But it's like, you know, it's like 55% of people can't be like uneducated enough to know that this is right or wrong, you know, that there's this whole system in place like feeding this stuff to people, you know. And
it's as real as fake gets.
Yeah. And then every time something like bubbles up to this, like the unboxing videos that are featured into it, you know, like that was one of the things I think for me of our age group where like that came into reality and I heard about it and I was like, I'm officially old. Yeah. Like I don't get like, you know what I mean? Like there was a lot of stuff that happens or like that you can kind of like relate to or somewhat understand that it becomes a cultural thing. But this thing of like 8-year-olds and younger and whatever, like watching other people unbox toys and talk about it or maybe not talk and they just unbox it and it's like ASMR, like unboxing, like stuff.
I love it.
It's definitely like a Ripley's Believe It or Not, like oddity, weird thing that I love in that way. But I was just like, my brain, like, I don't get it. Like,
well,
I just don't get it.
For me, that was all like the same kind of celebrity influencer culture.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
You have like the QAnon influencers and you have the doll unboxing influencers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's all just like, yeah.
It's like, they're all these different weird puppets of things.
And celebrity,
you know, that,
yeah.
Yeah.
Puppets. Very. Oh, you called them the puppets.
I even did air quotes.
Oh, word of the day. Just flip the table. You guys couldn't see it.
You're gonna have to sit down in the show.
Yeah. You did a Teresa Giudice.
Yeah, prostitution hall.
Shout out all the Jersey Housewives.
You're only 22, so.
Yeah, I heard from my older brother.
You don't know about that.
Yeah. This one, I should come in with the disclaimer that the thoughts and views are only mine.
I'll put that in at the beginning. No, probably should. So you're also working with a composer, right?
Yes, Joseph Hallman.
Yeah,
yes.
And is that like a, have you worked before with them or?
We're just at the beginning of our friendship, but he loves opera too, and so this is something that I've kind of been learning about for the past 4 years. I just met him online, and we've been, I don't know, he'll tell me cool things to listen to, and I just really like his like new music, and so someday I would love to do an opera with him.
That's is opera something that you've goal. Been interested in for a long time?
No, or like just, of, or recently, just recently. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but then it became my whole personality.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's
yeah,
just what
just
you are
my
now.
My whole life is it now.
Is opera.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah. I can't just like something.
It just like, takes over.
Mom, this is who I am now.
Are you able to do that with multiple things at once? Like,
yeah,
can you have
definitely.
Multiple obsessions?
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
A lot of time in the day.
Mine, I'm very specific. One thing at a time. Can't do a bunch of different ones at the same time.
You got to juggle them.
Yeah. So I can keep going. I'll keep going. Like, I don't know if you guys have questions or, like, things, anything you wanted to address or talk about. But I'll just keep going unless
question.
You interrupt me.
Can I ask a question to Bailey?
Yeah.
Okay, so if anyone listens to this podcast, it'll be after the premiere tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious what you want to leave the audience with, like in that grand finale with Old Put. I spoke before about like the genre-defying
spoilers.
Thing. Oh yeah, is that okay?
Yeah, that's no, fine. It is going to be after.
Yeah.
It's such a mixed bag. And for my own personal reaction to like how Old Put's character unfurls and how the sort of epic that is Conspiracy Influencer unfurls. So I'm wondering, what do you want people to really take with them?
I was just thinking about how we consume culture and like what the purpose of, okay, so Old Put is like oddly an artist too, and there's like a lot of like insider talk about art.
Yeah.
But I try to make it about like Scream or other things. But so it ends with Old Put has vampire teeth, because in the beginning Pink Gloves, who's a serial reanimator, don't get confused with a serial killer, they need Old Put so that they can come together to create something tangible and real, as opposed to like an artist that I think that just sucks the life out of everything. So at the end, we'll put like kind of embraces that and mm-hmm. becomes like a Nosferatu.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll suck all the life out of culture.
Yeah.
So I guess you should just be left with, I don't know, thinking about purpose, life's purpose.
Fantastic.
Just they
the
just
big
should
question.
Be, yeah, they should just be a changed being when they leave the theater. The lights come on and everyone is like, oh my god.
Yeah.
My favorite artist, I always say this, is Jack Smith, and he also did like plays and had all these different personas. And I like his work because I always am able to think differently about what this country is about, where we're going, why we do things, everything. He has everything in his plays. So yeah.
Well, I definitely appreciate the complexity of Old Put.
Yeah.
It goes from protagonist to antagonist back again. And,
I'm a victim.
And, you know, how long has Old Put been a part of you? Like, forever? Or, like, you know, at what point did, you know, there's a difference between, like, I'm writing something, there's a character in it, mm-hmm. and, like, I'm doing something and I have an alternate persona that exists, you know, and like, could you talk about that a little bit? Like, at what point that became something more to you than like a character that you were just making something for?
Isabella and I were talking about this when I was a very lonely child. So I had like all these like characters and things that I would make, and Old Put was definitely one of them. And then once I was in college, I started seeing all these other artists that were doing drag, and this was before Drag Race, children. Mm-hmm. Like.
Bailey was the first person I ever knew that watched Drag Race.
Oh, I was watching
like
it from
lo-fi
the very
season
start.
One and two.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, this is never going to take off. What is she doing?
Well, when was that? Like 2004? Like when was that?
It must have been 2007 or
2007,
eight.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, maybe 2008, because we were at Cooper 2007.
Because it was after Next Top Model. So I remember
that.
Oh, yeah,
for sure.
Well, yeah, I loved that show, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. That was, like,
smizing.
But I grew up, I loved Divine. I thought Divine was, like, the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. And my brother, when I was 13, he was like, that's a dude. Like, no. What? I got blue pill.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I always had this like super hardcore interest in drag.
And
so it was like Old Put, who's this like character I'd played with as a child and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of was able to like embody them.
Yeah. Cool.
But after college, I feel like there was this whole myth, like you had moved back to Detroit after college, whatever, and it was like, oh, where'd Bailey go? And then it was like, she went to become a clown.
Yeah, for real.
Like in the tradition of the saga, finished the academy and went off into the wilderness to find themselves as a clown.
Went to a very pretentious art school only to be like, I don't want to paint a canvas. I want to paint my face.
There was no other choice. There's really no other choice. I was going to say not to make it serious again, but like nothing has been serious, so it's really hard to tell exactly what that word means. But, you know, I was there, this idea of like characters and things, like even in your paintings, you know, and drawings that I was looking at, you know, everything, there's like a portraiture as like almost every, even the characters that, in order for an idea to be like, thing, like there's just like a person or an object or a thing associated
identity
that like is created for it, you know, and I don't know if there's anything in that like that is a reason why, you know, like I just think it's really interesting that I didn't expect when I went started to go through all of the paintings that I could find, you know, that of yours, that they're all like character based or portrait based, you know what I mean, and they're like abstract in a way, and there is this kind of like colorful abstract experience with like everything, but then it's all like everything is very grounded in it being human or like a character, you know, and characters that are not human are still you know, what's that Disney word, like anthropomorphized into being being human like you know, I just know that was like part of that process of like exploring ideas or objects, you know, or sculpture, that it always kind of seems to have this root in.
Yeah. The root for everything for me has always been like, what is the American identity? It's something I've always been kind of interested in, even with my paintings. The paintings are like reproductions of or repaintings of early American portraiture.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of put the conspiracy theories into them, thinking that like, maybe these ideas have been with us from the beginning, and so,
yeah.
I love eyes, though.
Yeah, eyeballs.
Like, I'm obsessed with eyes, and even when I'm here, I'm like, do I look at people in eyes? I'm constantly thinking about eyes.
Yeah.
I love a portrait. It's just two eyes.
Yeah.
With stuff.
And, I mean, hands are really hard to draw, so it's just nice to just, you know, forget that just whole, like, below
think about eyes and stuff, yeah.
Just eyes and stuff and nose.
It was also that, like, the in the play Tiffany, Tiff, the auctioneer, gives like a little summation of a painting about the traveling painter, which is actually like art historical fact.
Yeah, that's John Brewster Jr., who's my favorite painter of all time. Yeah,
that would like.
He rode around on a donkey.
Yeah, like the landed gentry in America lived so far apart from each other. There were like no urban centers that these American portraitists would go with pre-painted paintings that were missing everything except like the
their faces,
face,
right?
So that then they could like quickly get to whatever family was living in the, you know, colonizer family was living in the Ohio Valley,
right?
And it even has this like dark trauma to it, because it's like they had to paint these children because most of them didn't live.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like you got to get the portrait.
Well, it's hot. The
yeah,
guy's
get
here
it while.
To do it.
Yeah, who knows what's gonna happen?
That kid might not be here. You better buy one of my paintings.
That was why I asked. I was once in this gallery. I was like, literally, it's all children. Like. And they're like, oh, because they didn't know if they were going to die.
Right.
Like, oh, fuck.
It's like, and it was
welcome
like,
to America, baby! Yeah.
Where you don't know if your kid's going to live. Yeah, and it's like pre-Photoshop photo, you know what I mean? It's like these like pre-Photoshop green screen equivalents of like a bunch of pre-painted canvases of babies in onesies that they just
like
put some other faces in whenever they need to. Very cool. Very cool. cool idea, guys.
What a melange.
I like that we ended at early childhood. our puppet show discussion has ended in American Death.
So tune in to see what happens next.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it really, oh, sorry, not to cut in, but it really does show how, as we said before, how deep these ideas that you're dealing with go. And you can really read it as like a surface level kind of pop culture campy thing, but I think you're so
effective. Which I always find interesting too. Like, somebody enjoys it just because it's like a gold leafed painting.
Totally.
They just like gold.
Just like the shininess of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lizard brains.
And then I'm like, it's really about childhood death in early America. So
where did you grow up?
Right outside of Detroit.
All right.
Yeah.
And so were your parents like local to that area? I mean, what?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, like, the, you know, I guess the interest in like American ideal culture, like, you know, this sort of like that also I think is a generational. Mm-hmm. You know, like Nickelodeon and Disney and like all these, you know, from Rugrats to like, you know, you were really kind of, I think, the first testing ground lab of like this force feeding of a different idea of what life was like supposed to be like, you know, and everyone thought it was kind of these everybody gets a trophy generation. And it was like, you kids are, you know, you don't, everyone got a trophy, but it was more like for all of us, we're like, we all got trophies. And like, you know, really trying to like figure out, like, this is what I was told life was gonna be like all the time, like you fall in love and then you're in love like forever and it's like amazing and like this is what life is gonna end up like, I just gotta get through middle school or something, you know. Well, and then it was like, I don't know about you guys, like, it was like a little traumatic, like figuring out that that's not how it pans out.
I had like cynical parents that didn't like Disney. They were like, we really? Don't like happy endings. So then I would be the smart aleck at school. Like, I don't like that. It doesn't have a happy, or has a happy ending.
Yeah. So you didn't get to like binge on Disney and things like that.
But then like, you know, like you were saying, Rugrats or Ren and Stimpy, like that's allowed.
That was allowed.
Yeah. Wrestling, like the most homoerotic.
Yeah. They were cool.
Like
with
I could
that.
Be watching.
Yeah. So you weren't like surrounded by art in a way growing up, like was this like part of your family?
I
like,
was though. My mom, yeah, like... my mom has an MFA in drawing.
Oh, wow.
And so, and she had lots and lots of art monographs. Like, so I, like most of my lonely childhood was like looking at like different artists, and yeah, and then I loved drawing as a child. Like,
yeah,
that was my thing. Yeah. Uh-huh. So.
And then you that kind of. At what point did you kind of figure out or think that it was an option that like,
I mean,
art
like,
making was like what you wanted
to do? My earliest memory literally was like, I'm going to be an artist.
Yeah. And that's what it was going to be.
Yeah. Like I'm going to draw hamsters and people are going to love them. I used to have all these hamster drawings.
Yeah. They're going to pay me so much money.
And I'm going to live in a loft.
Yeah. Had it all figured out.
Yeah.
You knew exactly what was going to happen.
And I'm going to be like Basquiat.
Cool. Well, I'm excited to see the show tonight in its full on glory with audience and, you know, the all out performance of everyone. I think it's going to be pretty amazing. Is there any other stuff that anyone wanted to touch on or talk about as we...
Should get a social media shout out.
Yeah, you want to just plug your social medias if you want to, or... No.
Oh.
Bailey, go
sure.
for it. Yeah,
Bailey.
Yeah.
Baileyoni. B-A-I-L-I-O-N-I. It's like over everything. Baileyoni.
When I was learning how to pronounce your last name, someone told me it's like Shasta. The drink, right?
Fresca.
Oh, Fresca. Not Shasta.
What's Shasta?
I was like, Shasta is something else. It's not very good.
It's another reference.
At the time, I was like, that's a very appropriate can, like, because it's like a very colorful, you know, I was like, oh, I don't know if I really could have picked what would be like
is
a
it your
better...
favorite beverage to riff on Faygo?
Faygo, oh yeah. Oh, it's a Detroit specialty.
That's that ICP drink that you dump on people, right?
Yeah,
isn't that what you do with that? That's not culture.
I got one in my face at an ICP concert. Yeah, just shake them up and throw them out. Yeah.
That's a good way to sell products. I mean, they must sell a lot of products by just
It's double the sugar of a regular soda.
Oh, there you go.
Wow.
Yikes. I had
no
Which is a lot.
Delicious.
Yeah. Whoop, whoop. Shout out to all the juggalos. Juggalos and juggalettes, this is for you.
We have a really big juggalo following on the podcast, so I think a lot of people will get the reference.
That's how I got on.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about ICP, but maybe for the next podcast. Yeah.
It's itching to be made.
Next residency.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks so much.
But
for talking.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah, of course.
So there will be online premiere. I don't know when this
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if this will be out in time for the online premiere, okay. But if the online premiere on Thursday the 26th mm-hmm. at 7 p.m.
Of May,
mm-hmm. is documented or stays up online to be watched, then whatever channels that it is on, you could look at. Are you guys, is it being online premiered through the MPAC situation as well as other places or through MPAC?
Through MPAC.
So you can always just go to MPAC's website, mpac.rpi.edu, mm-hmm. do a little Google Kung Fu, whatever you got to do.
What the hell we're talking
about. And you'll get a little bit more understanding of what we all just talked through.
And before we, oh, my bad. That's a
go ahead.
Before we go too, I just feel like we really should thank everyone at MPAC because we produce so much stuff during this residency here at MPAC in the facilities, including video works, you know, with sort of green screen technology and
audio,
you know, audio production. I mean, you know,
lighting,
like everything, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. And it was just, I mean, it was great.
It was amazing.
Yeah. So.
Dream come true.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have a good time. Thanks, MPAC. Yeah.
Thanks for listening. In Production is produced by me, Ryan Jenkins, along with Vic Brooks and Ashley Farrow Murray, with the support from everyone here at MPAC. Both a center for the media and performing arts and a research and production facility, MPAC at Rensselaer hosts artists in residence year-round to support the realization of complex artworks and research projects at any stage, from inception to completion. To find out more about MPAC, visit www.mpac.rpi.edu and our Instagram account at @empac_RPI. All opinions expressed here belong solely to those featured in this episode and are not representative of Rensselaer.